after that wonderfully smooth start, why don't we get going? I'm delighted to see you on this steamy evening, and we can sweat our way through the next little while together thinking about community. I'm Jody Kretzman, and I'm delighted to be here. I teach at Northwestern University in Chicago and Evanston, and direct something called the Asset-Based Community Development, ABCD, Institute there. Institute, my colleague John McKnight and I now work on with thousands of colleagues on six different continents, thinking about how power and communities come together. So what I want to do is to give you a little bit of overview of that work, some of the principles, some of the discoveries, some of the real excitement that continues to animate this work and grow. Let me just take a quick survey here. How many of you have any familiarity with the asset-based community development idea? Okay, a handful anyway. I will expect tough and complicated questions from you guys, and any kinds of questions from the rest of you. but I think it's probably, let me apologize to the veterans in the room, it probably makes sense to do a little bit of an overview and background for folks, if that's all right. The session is called How to Destroy and Rebuild Communities. Yeah. I hope that the emphasis is going to be on rebuilding, not destruction, but I think it's important to understand destruction if one is committed to the rebuilding process. A word of autobiography might be helpful. I've been at this a long time, and it's been a wonderful, creative, life-giving way to live one's life. It started for me, but in Julia's term, it was not a conversion, but a revelation, when between my sophomore and junior year in college, many decades ago, I answered, we got another one. It was in a closet upstairs.
All right. Do you want a third backup?
Sure. You can't ever have too many overheads. Yeah. Absolutely.
Isn't this what we asset-based community?
That's right. That's right. How many overheads did it take? To, right. This is like the loaves and fishes, the multiplication of the overheads. So between my sophomore and junior years, I grew up in a place where my family was a little bit involved in the civil rights movement, and it was a lively kind of upbringing. But the real sort of revelation in my life came when an invitation was sent to a bunch of northern universities where I was to join some incredibly courageous young African American students in the South who had decided that it was time that black folks in the South might begin to enter the American democracy. Might begin to be allowed to vote. And these incredibly courageous young people who had started as freedom riders and then formed themselves into a group called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, organized a summer in a place called Mississippi. So it was called Mississippi Summer, and invited people from northern colleges and universities to join them for some work on voter registration and teaching in places called freedom schools. So a whole lot of us, not a whole lot of us, but hundreds of us responded to that. I did too. I spent a mere 5.5 weeks in Mississippi, north of Greenwood, and it changed my life, not in a conversion way, but in a revelatory way. Expanding what I think that my life began to be about. I lived with an extended African American family of sharecroppers who were the descendants of slaves. There were 53 people in this extended family, and they lived in a series of 11 what one could only call shacks. Five of the shacks, as I recall, had wooden floors. The rest had dirt floors. There was no indoor plumbing, obviously. There was no running water. They were allowed to keep some of what they farmed. It was a sharecropping deal. The most advanced formal education in this extended African-American family was sixth grade. And it was a family that ranged in age from zero to 86, I think was the oldest. And so I spent 5.5 weeks being part of their family, and they were immensely welcoming and immensely embracing and immensely powerful as teachers. And it began occurring to me about 3 or 4 weeks, maybe a little before that, into this experience, that having spent a night or two in jail and having been shot at a couple of times, we went. This was right after, those of you who know about Mississippi Summer, was right after Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney were killed, or at least had disappeared. They had not found the bodies when I got down there. But it occurred to me that I was learning much more in this period of time with this extended African-American family and with the young people who were organizing throughout Mississippi than I had ever learned in any classroom in my first 2 years at Princeton, where I was. And afterwards, it occurred to me that I had learned more during this period of time with these folks about important topics than I would ever learn in my undergraduate years at Princeton or in all of my graduate studies. I learned more about faith, about courage, about family, about the power of intergenerational work together, about what somebody later called the audacity of hope. All of the stuff that I thought seemed to me to be the most important stuff in life and was not a part of the classroom at Princeton. So out of that experience, one of the things that I took was a kind of a vow to myself that I would take every excuse I could possibly find for the rest of my life, that continued to make sense, to spend time in struggling communities, and particularly in struggling communities that were trying to change history, that were trying to make a difference in the fate and future of their people. And so that's basically what I've done. That led me to drop out of graduate school a number of times. It led me to leave a journalism career at Time Magazine. It led me to led me back to Chicago after a while, where I became something which is now, which used to be a sort of mysterious word, but is now not so mysterious. I became a community organizer in Chicago, on the west side of Chicago, and have been mostly hanging out in struggling communities across America and now across six continents ever since. And what I've been trying to do is what came to me naturally to do in Mississippi, which is to keep my ear to the ground, to listen to people, to try to figure out what folks were doing in terrifically tough situations to make a difference, to do something that that injected hope into a hopeless situation. And it early on occurred to me that the way to communicate that best was not necessarily to do studies and statistical analyses and surveys, although I think those are important, but to gather stories. And so a lot of my work, besides sort of being working with, walking with, strategizing with communities, is collecting their stories. And trying to figure out with them what the stories meant. So mainly what I want to do in the next little while with you is to share a couple of the some of the key stories in this journey and what they have taught us and see where they're going today. It happens that there's a couple people in the White House who know these stories too and are interested in spreading them so that the work is very compelling and hopeful at this particular moment in history. There's also a recent volume, 6 months off the press, about that this kind of work on six different continents, collections of case studies from around the world from people who work in this way. So, let me tell you a couple stories. Along the way of collecting contemporary community building stories, my colleagues and I began noticing that there were a lot of stories that came out of people's traditions, faith traditions and cultural traditions, that had the same kinds of lessons. And so what I want to do is start tonight with a story that has become one of my favorite and goes right to the core of, I think, what we've been taught in the 20th and 21st centuries, but it's much older than that. And it's a story that comes from the Sufi Muslim tradition. Do people know Sufi stories? Anybody who are? They're a wonderful storytelling culture, have all kinds of wonderful cultural attributes that define their faith together. Those of you who know Sufi stories, though, know that there's a quirkiness to them from our point of view. And one of the quirky things about them is that, unlike our Western way of telling a story, the Sufi story usually starts with the moral. So there's no suspense. Right? You know what the moral is from the beginning, and then the story sort of unfolds around the moral, right? Rather than, we know if you're preaching someplace, right, you sort of lead up to the climax, and the climax is about what is all this about? This is what it's about. It's about grace and faith and so on. But not the Sufi stories. The Sufi stories start with the moral. So I want to tell you a Sufi story. The moral of the story is, anybody in here a teacher? That's okay. The moral of the story is, you will only learn what you already know. Okay? You'll only learn what you already know, which is a humbling thought for teachers. Here's the story. There was a village in the Middle East in deep trouble. All of the bad indicators were going even worse. The unemployment was up and the economy was down and the drought was hitting and the households were breaking up. The village was in deep trouble. And the villagers began meeting about these troubles to try to figure out what to do about them. And the elders of the village, in the one of many meetings, one of the elders said, "You know, we are in deep trouble. We probably can't get out of it ourselves, but I know that I have heard that there is this wise person from another village who knows how to get villages out of trouble. And what we could do is to invite this wise person to help us get out of trouble." And so they issued an invitation, and they received an affirmative reply, and in time, the wise woman came to the village. And when the wise woman arrived in the village, she gathered the villagers in front of her on the square, and she asked a question. She said, "Do you know what I'm going to tell you?" And looking puzzled in unison, the villagers shouted, "No, we wouldn't have asked you if we knew." And so the wise woman said, "Well, in my experience, you will only learn what you already know. And if you don't know what I'm going to tell you, I have nothing to say." And she left. It was a very short technical assistance visit. Well, the villagers felt ripped off. And so they met, and they decided, this woman has a terrific reputation. Let's invite her again and see whether we can get something out of her. They invited her back a second time. She gathered the villagers. Again, she asked her questions. "Do you know what I'm going to tell you?" And this time, the villagers, knowing a trick question when they heard one, answered in unison, "Yes, we do." And so the wise woman said, "Well, if you know what I'm going to tell you, I have nothing left to say." She left. So the villagers, once again feeling mightily frustrated, decided, "Well, let's try again." And they invited her back for a third visit, and she came back and once again gathered the villagers and asked her question, "Do you know what I'm going to tell you?" And this time, the villagers, having been completely rehearsed, in unison, half of the villagers shout, "Yes," and half of the villagers shout, "No." And the wise woman looked out and said, "Now, will all of the people who know what I'm going to tell you tell all of the people who don't know?" And that way, she said, "We'll all know." And she left, and she never came back again, nor was she invited. And that night, a leader in the village had a dream. And the leader reported the dream out the next morning to the gathered villagers. And she said, "In my dream last night, I had a visit from the wise woman who told me the meaning of the message that she wanted to convey to the village." She said she wanted the village to know that any really important knowledge was already here in our culture, in our history, in our experience, in our knowledge, and most of all in our relationships with each other. That we don't need to look to outside experts first. That we've got what we need here to begin down the path of regeneration. She said, "The only thing the wise woman told us that we lacked was the belief that we have what we need." Right? So that's a Sufi story from probably 8 centuries ago about the Middle East. And I guess the short of what I have to tell you tonight is that piece of wisdom from the wise woman is exactly true in North America in the year 2009. And in a lot of the developing world as well. And a lot of the developed world. When we set out to collect the stories for building communities from the inside out, there's now probably 150,000 of those out there. My colleague John McKnight and I decided we wanted to visit the 25 largest cities in the United States repeatedly for a period of 3.5 years and spend a lot of time getting to know the most devastated neighborhoods in those places. And when we weren't in the devastated neighborhoods of urban America, we went to spend time on Native people's reservations and in Appalachian towns and in dying Midwestern farm towns. We wanted to go to the most challenged places. But we did not want to do what most visiting academics did when encountering devastated places. We didn't want to study the problems. Instead, we wanted to find the instances where committed, smart, grassroots folks were making a difference, where they were doing stuff that sort of generated some hope in tough situations. So we ended up gathering in a 3.5 year period, not just the two of us, but a network of folks across the country, over 3,000 stories that we started calling hope stories. So they were stories about where the community had taken the parks back from the drug dealers, where folks had gotten together to begin to turn a terrible failing school around, where people had begun to rebuild an economy, where people had invited through microfinance and other kinds of tools, women and other marginalized folks back into economic activity, where folks had taken kids out of gang activity and began to reveal a kind of promising future. So we got over 3,000 of those. And then we sort of put them together and had a discussion that was this kind of national discussion with people in the communities across the country. About what does this mean? What are the lessons here? What could you draw out of studying success for a change rather than failure? And that's what I want to just concentrate briefly. We began, after a while, we learned a whole bunch of stuff, and we continued to learn a whole bunch of stuff. But we began zeroing in on a central set of lessons. And the central set of lessons was clarified for me, I think, most powerfully by a woman who had become a hugely important mentor and teacher of mine. And I do try to keep her name alive. She was an African American woman who died at the age of 86, 9 years ago now, named Mrs. Edna Johnson. And Mrs. Johnson was an extraordinary community builder. She lived 50 of her 86 years, the last 50, in a place called the South Bronx in New York City. Few of you like me are old enough to remember when the South Bronx was sort of the epitome of urban failure. Is that right? At least in the 70s and 80s. Most people, you know, if it was broken any place, it wasn't Pittsburgh or Chicago, it was, or Portland or Seattle, it was the South Bronx. Just the South Bronx was a place that had lost over 100,000 jobs in a decade. Jobs had left for the suburbs or for the Sun Belt, or they had just disappeared entirely. The South Bronx was a place where every institution was broken, where the longer kids stayed in school, the dumber they got by all of the statistics. Where the criminal justice system was absolutely fabulous at producing criminals and not so good at producing justice. Where this wonderful practice, which was then exported to my city, Chicago, was invented, a practice called arson for profit. How many people have heard of arson for profit, man? Where the landlord would pack a building, absentee landlord would pack an apartment building filled with poor people, collect their rents for a few years, and not put a dime back into the building. The building would deteriorate, everything would be falling apart, it would be unlivable, people began moving out. And just as the last person moved out, the landlord would hire an arsonist to burn down the building for the insurance money. You know, it's arson for profit. And people estimate that the South Bronx lost over 60,000 units of affordable housing to arson for profit, and then that was exported to my town in Chicago and other places. All this is to say the South Bronx was a tough place. But my friend, Mrs. Johnson, and teacher, Mrs. Johnson, was somebody who was always under the radar, not in the headlines of the New York Times, but under the radar, putting the people together and the ideas together and the creativity and the energies together to make hope stories happen. They were small hope stories, but they were important hope stories. She was turning around the community block by block. She started a wonderful group in the South Bronx called the Banana Kelly Community Development Corporation. Kelly Street is in the middle of the South Bronx and it's shaped like a banana, so the Banana Kelly Community Development Corporation. And she was constantly doing stuff that ignited hope in people. One morning, it was about this hot. I guess this is one of the reasons I'm thinking about this tonight. I was visiting her in the South Bronx. She called us out there maybe a dozen times over this 3-year period to see new things that she had found and was involved with that were going on. And she was really excited about a new one. And she called me out and said, "Jody, you've got to come with me and visit this." And we did. And what it was we went up three stories to an unfurnished apartment and spent the morning with 14 young men, ages 15 to 19, all African American. And they talked to us about the story of their lives. And I won't go into detail, I could spend hours on this. But we spent 3.5 hours listening to them, essentially. And here was the story we got. A year and a half before this, two rival gangs in the South Bronx had a really tough dispute over turf around drug dealing and had brought out the heavy weapons. And within a 2-week period, 22 young people were killed, which even in the South Bronx was a lot. And so these young men who we were talking to were part of that. They were part of both gangs. And they told us the story of beginning to say, "This doesn't make sense in our lives. We need to do something else with our lives." And slowly, one by one, one-on-one, they got a group of 14 of them together, and they made a sort of pledge with each other. "We're going to help each other turn our lives around. If we keep on this path, we're going to be either dead or in jail." So of course, none of them knew what to do about how to turn their lives around. There was no, you know, there's a paucity of ideas here. But luckily, two of these guys knew Mrs. Johnson and went to Mrs. Johnson and said, "We've got some guys who want to turn their lives around. Do you have any ideas?" And of course, Mrs. Johnson always had ideas to do. And so she took first the two leaders and then all 14 guys down to the neighborhood south of there called Harlem, where there was the first experimental activity, which has now grown into a national program and is in over 100 cities nationwide, federally funded. The program is called Youth Build. Anybody know about Youth Build? It takes kids in trouble, mostly in gang situations, right? And teaches them some basic carpentry skills and some plumbing skills and some drywalling skills and some painting skills. And puts them in teams and turns them loose to rehabilitate burned out and dilapidated housing and bring affordable housing back onto the market. So this first little experiment with this going, what's going on in Harlem, and the kids from the South Bronx went down and looked at that and got really excited. Mrs. Johnson was already excited about it. She was delighted to see the kids get excited about it. All 14 of them went down, did a week of sort of shadowing and apprenticing with the Harlem kids, and were very clear, Mrs. Johnson, you got to help us get the second chapter of Youth Build started. So that's the story we were told, how these 14 young men were turning their lives around. And so they were telling us stories about a year and a half ago facing jail and death. And today, some of them were apprentice carpenters, and others of them were finishing their GEDs in high school, and others of them had reclaimed the children they had fathered and reconnected with the women with whom they had fathered these children. Some of them were even thinking about college. And all of them had hopeful horizons that had appeared for them. And it was an immensely moving 3.5 hours as these kids sort of, first reluctantly, but then with a good deal of energy and feeding with each other, told Mrs. Johnson and I about what had happened to them. So we go back after this session to Mrs. Johnson's front porch, and we're sort of debriefing this. And Mrs. Johnson's a visionary, and she immediately says to me, Jody, this could be a national program. This was far before this was even a possibility. But she started working on that right away. And we talked about how, what might be the next steps might be about doing that, growing this kind of a program. There was a lull in the conversation. And I have no idea why, but during the lull, sometime I asked her a question which I had never asked before. And the question was, because we were so focused on trying to get these hope stories, I hadn't thought about the other kind of question, but I asked her this now. I said, that was terrific. And you're involved in so many other things here that are sprigs of hope growing up. But it's still the South Bronx, I said. I was being my cynical self. And it's still probably the most devastated neighborhood in the United States. What do you think happened here? Do you have an explanation? I've never asked you before how you understand what caused this devastation. Right? And she was such an incredibly thoughtful woman. She paused for probably 40 seconds, silence. And I think what she was doing was scrolling through her mind all of the potentially correct answers to that question, right? It's the 100,000 jobs we lost. It's the institutions that don't work. It's the arson for profit. It's the racism that's clearly evident in our community. But she didn't say any of that. After the pause, she said, I'm not sure about this, Jody, but I think that the worst thing that ever happened to us in my neighborhood is that we got put into a prison. Right? Poach on my wife Ingrid's territory. And I said, I don't know what you mean. We're sitting on your front porch and there's a streetscape out here with some abandoned buildings, some rehab buildings, some empty lots. It's a varied streetscape. But what you don't see is high walls and barbed wire, right? Machine gun toting guards. What do you mean you've been put into a prison? And she said, thanks for the question, but I don't mean that kind of a literal prison. And then she uttered the words that's been sort of bouncing around our heads ever since. She said, the prison I'm talking about is a prison made up of other people's ideas about who we are. Prison made up of other people's ideas about who we are in my neighborhood. I said, that sounds important. I don't think I get it. could you tell me some more? And she said, well, let me just tell you what happens to me. And almost every week, I am involved in so many projects here in my neighborhood in the South Bronx that I have to go out to City Hall in the south end of Manhattan, or I have to go out to the suburbs. I have to get political and governmental support for what I'm doing here, or I have to go out and get money from churches in the suburbs or funders. And she said, let me tell you what happens. Almost every time, this is the pattern. I walk into the room, I introduce myself, I said, I've called ahead. I'm Mrs. Edna Johnson, I'm here to talk to you about my neighborhood. And she said, somebody very friendly and welcoming, says something welcoming to me, and then I'm usually asked, now remind me, what neighborhood is that that you'd like to talk to us about? And she says to me, Mrs. Johnson says to me, I try to say the name of my neighborhood with a lilt in my voice. I'm from the South Bronx. But she says, the lilt never works. The minute I say the word South Bronx, I can see what happens to people's heads. People's heads just fill up with images and ideas about my neighborhood. She said, almost none of these people have ever been to the South Bronx, but they think they know what it is. And I can see what let me just open it up for a minute. What kind of images and ideas do you think flow into people's heads when the words South Bronx are spoken? Shout
Fort
it out.
Apache. Fort Apache.
Fort Apache, the Bronx, the great Paul Newman movie, right? Yeah. What else? What the elements of Fort Apache, the Bronx, right?
Crack houses.
And graffiti.
Crack houses. And graffiti.
Graffiti. Right. Keep it coming.
Your car will be stripped in up 10 minutes if you leave it.
Okay.
Gangs.
Gangs. All right. So you're doing the job that Mrs. Johnson and others have helped us to do, which is to draw, if you will, a neighborhood needs map. This is not a map of a piece of geography. It's the map, a map sort of the mind. It's what Mrs. Johnson was saying. She saw almost inevitably filling up people's heads. Oh, I know that place. That's crime, child abuse, graffiti, mental disability, welfare, dropouts, illiteracy. And this is the map that Mrs. Johnson said constituted for her and her neighbors a prison. Can you see how it would? Let me just spend a second on thinking with you about this map, because we've done a lot of thinking about it since we began getting clarity. Two items I want to concentrate on. Number one, its origins, and number two, its consequences. You remember how Mrs. Johnson put it to me? This is somebody else's idea about who we are. So this is not my idea, she says, or my neighbor's idea, but somebody else has this idea. So now the floor is open for your nominations for cartographer of the year. Who draws the needs map? Where does this come from?
City Hall.
Okay. How does that happen? Say a little.
I suppose they have a council person who
Okay. Inside
of council meeting, that's what they kind of share.
Okay. Two elements here on the political side. Number one, you've got a council person who needs re-elected. So you've got a political process, and if I'm a political office holder, I have to paint myself every 2 or 4 years as a problem solver, which means I'm also a problem identifier. And the worse I can make this seem, the more I can position myself as somebody who is the solution to these problems. The other element that you're pointing to, I think, in city council, and it's true of all government, how many people here have written grant requests to either public sector or, in this case, philanthropic or foundation? Well, a number of people have, right? What's the first page?
Problem statement.
Problem statement, needs assessment, needs survey. So what's the game is, the more adroit you are at painting this map, the more likely you are to get resources from the outside.
So social service agencies.
Social service agencies as well, absolutely.
They're in the business.
That's right. That's exactly right. So we've got government and politics. We've got grants of all kinds. We've got social service. Who else?
Nonprofits.
Corporations.
Nonprofits,
okay.
Corporations.
Some who will see this and say that's not a place we want to invest, right? Okay.
The school system will use that to try and get more help from the feds.
Yep, to some degree, absolutely. I haven't heard, you know, if I were in the basement on the west side of Chicago, I haven't yet quite heard the one that I'm almost always hearing is first. Who paints this map?
Media?
Yes, thank you, Kate. The media, right? Most people in cities will say, it's the downtown media who think about us in this way. Right? We've got a journalism school at Northwestern, a very low thought of journalism school at Medill. And it is still true at Medill that when young journalists first are sent out to cover inner city communities, that's the code word, grizzled old faculty people who used to cover inner city communities will say, remember the rule, the journalistic rule, when you're covering those kinds of neighborhoods. Anybody know the rule? If it bleeds, it leads. Right? So the stories, what's news out of our neighborhood, these kinds of neighborhoods, is the drive-by shootings and the gang wars. Right? If it bleeds, it leads. Let me add one other nominee to the cartographer of the year listing here, and that is universities. I think that most social scientists, when they're talking about particularly struggling communities, whether in cities or rural or small town, start with this, that it's about urban problems, it's about urban issues, and they tend to write about the multiple causality among these variety deficiencies. That's what urban scholarship usually is. Right?
I'm just wondering, I mean, it seems like you can, certain people with certain interests can position or rearrange these in order to, say, get funding or to you know, sort of be the solution. It also seems like there's a certain point at which bottomless pit becomes the new title and people don't want to do anything because they've got a dollar and they should spend it over here instead of over here.
Yeah, that's a delicate balancing act, isn't it? You've got to show enough need to make sure that you're still the focus of attention, but you've got to paint yourself as not so hopeless that it's not a bottomless pit. Yeah. I mean, that's the balancing act that an awful lot of people inside communities are constantly dealing with, I think.
However, it does seem like if you're talking about academia or if you're talking about local power, with both those being systems of power, that it's going to go from being acute to chronic. Because systems build things and keep things going a certain way.
I think that's right.
So the fluidity.
That's right.
And also it's going to be white people deciding that that's the case.
Yeah, that's right. There's a racial dimension here.
There's a racial dimension.
As well as an economic dimension, right. So you're beginning to get into the consequences, and let me just say a little bit more about
that. Well, and also the sources of that type of labeling.
Yeah. Let me just say a word about some of the consequences. If that needs map is the only map to reality. Now, let me clear about this. The problem with the needs map is not that it is a false map. It's a true map, right? I live in a neighborhood in Chicago called Uptown, and we've got all of those problems, and 30 more. The problem is that it's not the whole truth. And it's taken as if it is the whole truth. That's the problem, right? Now, if that is taken as the whole truth, it has some really devastating consequences. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this, but let me just quickly knock off a few of these. Maybe one of the most tragic things is if I'm living in a neighborhood that is designated as needy, problematic, and deficient, if I hear that often enough, I internalize it. I say, that must be true about me. I don't know enough to raise my kids. I don't have the skills to enter the job market. I can't join with my neighbors to keep the community safe. I'm a deficient and needy person. And once you define yourself in that way, it's very difficult to come out into powerful public space once again. If you don't think there are any relationships or any resources in the community, that this is a community defined by deficiencies, why would you ever think about turning to any neighbors or local churches, or local businesses for help. All the help is out there someplace, right? And you know the truth about relationships, which is that if you don't use them, they're like muscles. They atrophy, and they go weak. So local relationships are damaged, if not destroyed. The fourth and fifth are about money. Money comes into communities in categorical funding. Here's your teen pregnancy money. Here's your gang money. Here's your illiteracy money, on and on. And it just violates the wisdom of local folks who know that insofar as these problems are real, and they are, they're all intertwined. And you can't just take one of them and treat them. Money gets directed primarily toward professional helpers. Let me just tell you a quick story about some years ago. We were asked by some friends on the west side of Chicago and some very poor neighborhoods to help them understand. They said, we think there's a lot of money coming into our neighborhoods designated to help poor people. We'd like to know how much and where it goes, right? So we said, okay, and it turned out to be a very difficult research question, but we tried our best to tackle it. And here's what we found. I won't go into the whole difficulties, but this was at a time when official poverty, follow me, I won't get too statistical, official poverty for a family of four was you earned $12,400 or less. That was the poverty line, $12,400 for a family of four. We counted the public dollars coming into the community from a variety of different streams of money, right? And we tried to be very conservative about what we counted, what we didn't count, aimed to help poor people. How many dollars do you think came into these communities per every officially poor family of four? Is the question clear?
Mm-hmm.
Got a guess?
20,000. My guess is, well, I know that back in the days of CSA,
yeah,
the Services Administration, they had one program where they gave out $12,000 to families,
yeah,
and they were like, just gave it to them.
Yeah.
And measured, so it's in excess of $12,000.
Okay. That wasn't happening during this period of time,
yeah,
but yes, absolutely. So the finding at this particular period of time was that for every officially poor family of four, something like $27,000 was coming into the community, right? And you know the kicker, how much of the $27,000 actually went to or under the control of low-income people?
Zero.
7,000 is the answer. So about 7,000 went to low-income people. Where did the other 20,000 go?
To feed the system. To pay the social system.
Yeah. Certainly a large portion of it went to people whose job it was to help low-income people. Right? Some of that I don't know. So let me just report to you what some fairly cynical friends of ours on the West Side said to us when we reported this back to them and said, you know, we knew this already. This isn't really news to us. They said, but what I think you guys have proved was that it takes only one good poor neighborhood to support two middle-class ones. Now, I myself am not that cynical. I think a lot of that, some of that money anyway, did good and was well spent. But it makes you think a little bit about what are the motivations and systems here.
And one of the things that might be added to that list is that the money that comes in from the outside, it's in the block grant form.
Yeah.
A lot of times co-ops, there's a co-optation.
Absolutely.
And the leadership that could be really effective in helping working within the neighborhood, if asset building, gets diverted from that. And you can't work against your funding source.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is a great segue, thank you, to this next point, the leadership question. When I was trained as a community organizer by Saul Alinsky, Lindsay used to say, your first job when you go into a new neighborhood is find the natural leaders. He used to say, every neighborhood has natural leaders. He's not talking about elected officials or people who are visible. He's talking about the woman on the block whom all the young moms turn to when they've got a question, right? He's talking about the guy on the block who everybody knows can fix everything, right? The natural leaders, the grassroots folks who get to them. This is Johnson's, right, if you will. Find those. And sometimes people would say, well, Saul, what is a natural leader? And he would say something like, well, a natural leader is somebody with followers who can get something done. Right? Those two criteria. Well, today, it turns out, we have people who are called leaders in lots of our inner city communities whose major skill is raising money. And what does that take? Well, what it means they're really good at is drawing the needs map. In other words, their skill is not leading their neighbors to get something done. Their skill, in fact, is denigrating their neighbors so that the outside will send resources in. That's a very different kind of leadership, right? And a much more problematic kind, I think, to deal with. Well, I don't want to spend much more time. We do reward failure. You know, if you want to get the second or third year funding, you got to go back to the funding source and say, you know, we did everything we could, but unfortunately we have more young girls pregnant this year than we did last year. Give us more money. So the more you fail, you know, short of being hopeless, right, the more you're going to get funded from the outside. The community then leads to a downward kind of a spiral, poor self-image. Well, enough of this despondency. The good news is that in community after community in the United States and Canada and all across the world, people have, with Mrs. Johnson, said that's somebody else's idea about who we are. And what we really need to concentrate on is our own idea about the rest of our reality. What does a map of our assets look like? How can we begin to look at even this most devastated neighborhood and figure out what we've got, not what we don't have? Mrs. Johnson and others taught us, do one other quick symbol here, never to go anywhere without this. You see what it is? This is the cliche, half full, half empty glass, right? And the reason I always carry one with me, it's because it reminds me of a profound truth, a really simple one. But the half full, half empty glass is a terrifically important reminder that on two levels, we're all this way. On the individual level, every one of us in this room is partly full and partly empty. The theologians here will have to help translate this into something that makes sense to them. And on our community level, the same thing is true. Every community is partly full and partly empty. On the individual level, I sometimes invite people, if you really want to see empty, deficient, needy, problematic people, people with all kinds of trouble in their lives, come to the university and I'll introduce you to the faculty. At least at Northwestern, maybe it's not true at Cal Lutheran. Or Valpo, Dorothy, I don't know. But our faculty is really screwed up. We've got people who can't keep a marriage together. And I'm just talking about my immediate group of maybe 15 colleagues from different departments whose kids don't speak to them, drink too much. We've got all kinds of health problems. They're just a mess in so many ways in their lives. But at Northwestern, probably most other places, we usually recognize that we're part of a vast conspiracy, that we conspire on a daily and weekly basis, almost totally, to ignore each other's emptiness. We want to help each other, that's fine, we can support each other. But the way we work together is to recognize that these same screwed up people are wonderful teachers, they're terrific writers, they can frame a research topic, they love working with people called students. In other words, they can do what's necessary to make a great university run. I don't know about you, but my experience is that every organization I have ever worked with that works on the same principle. Management 101. Tom probably works at Holden Village too. Let's take screwed up people and see what they can do. right? See what their gifts are, what they can contribute. Right? That's true on an individual basis, but it's also true about communities. Every community is a combination of fullness and emptiness. Our problem is that we have been taught to wear glasses through which, when we look at communities, in some communities we see only emptiness, and in others we see only fullness. And the truth is that they are all combinations of both. And that the important question about the glass strategically is not the trick kids question. The kids always ask, is the glass half full or half empty? And the answer to that always is what? Yes.
Yes.
But from a community building point of view, the question always is, which part of the glass do you focus on? Do you focus first on the fullness or first on the emptiness? So the lessons from around the world have to do with what happens when we focus on the fullness. What does the fullness look like, and what do we do with it? One of the things that really did, I think, surprise my colleague McKnight and I when we were sort of collecting these 3,000 hope stories is we started seeing a pattern. People would tell us, when we'd ask, now, how did you make that happen? How did you turn that school around? How did you make that park friendly for families once again? They would tell us the story, and we would begin seeing patterns. And always at the core of the story was, we started with what we had, right? And what we had turned out, and this was the surprise, to begin to fall into six categories. And so we now think, I'll be really arrogant here because we've now worked on six different continents. We now think that there's not a community on Earth, whether we're talking about a remote indigenous village in the Ecuadorian highlands or downtown New York or Seattle, that is not its own unique combination of these six categories of assets. This is not rocket science. But what it is an attempt to say this mushy thing called community doesn't have to be quite so mushy. It's got some components. It's got some pieces to it. And you can work with these pieces and put them together. So this isn't that difficult. Let's start with every individual that lives there in this first category and regard them as at least half full, at least partly full. So communities are working with things called capacity inventories and skills inventories and gift conversations and all of the ways to get to what it is people have to contribute. Secondly, de Tocqueville first taught us this in the United States, people associate voluntarily in religious groups, in block clubs, in women's groups, in cultural groups, in youth groups, in athletic groups. We still think that's the core of community. One of our big dilemmas, and we can spend days on this in the work we do, is that the third category, the institutional and professional entities, this is the second category is unpaid work, voluntary work. The third is paid work. Two different ways that human beings get together to get things done. And Holden is constantly sort of playing with these two categories as well. But the paid work, nonprofit, for-profit, and public institutions, sometimes drowns out, pushes aside the voluntary groups. And that can be a real problem. And then obviously every community, urban or rural, small or large, has physical assets. Even in the poorest community, there are economic assets. People produce things, consume things. There's barter going on. And then finally, every community has at least some way of talking about their values and their heritage and their culture and their emerging sister disciplines to ours, ABCD, like appreciative inquiry. How many people know about appreciative inquiry? That are tremendously helpful, I think, in getting at some of the stories that define a community. So to summarize, we now think that sustainable community building and community development is a three-step process. Number one, find the assets. This is sometimes now called asset mapping. How do you figure out what's already here? And by the way, if communities do this seriously, the result almost always, always is, there's more here than anybody knows. They're constantly uncovering stuff that people had never noticed before as an asset. So find them, lift them up, celebrate them, have parties. Make sure that nobody, and I'm talking particularly about this devastated community, nobody ever has the excuse of saying, we don't have anything. We are defined by our emptiness. Everybody knows we've got something to work with, what that is. Secondly, after you found them, second step, connect them. Connect the assets. So when I got a call 2 years ago now from a young neighbor of mine who was 15 at the time, who urgently wanted to talk to me. This is a quick story about it. I was disturbed and moved enough to cancel the rest of my day and spend the rest of my day with Maria, my young neighbor. Maria was the daughter of a single mom, is the daughter of a single mom, and she was a wonderfully creative, vibrant young woman. And what she wanted to talk to me, she calls me Uncle Jody, was the fact that she had just discovered that she was pregnant. And she didn't know how her mom was going to respond to that. She was worried about it. So all I could do the first couple of hours with Maria was listen. And listen and listen and listen some more. And assure her that I'd be with her, whatever happened. I came home that night and thought about our conversation. And it became clear to me that I had a fork in the road to think about with Maria. That I wanted to do something to help her, to support her. One path I could go down is I could think about Maria as a pregnant teen, which she was. And therefore I could look, I've got a lot of connections, I could look around for the professional help that might be useful for her. Where are the schools that are best for young women who are pregnant? Where are the counseling resources and so on? That's one path. But somehow that didn't feel right to me. And it became clearer and clearer as I thought it through that there's another path. And the other path was, well, why don't I keep thinking about Maria the way I've always thought about Maria? As a vibrant, bright, funny, energetic, talented young woman who had a lot of things going for her, including, since age 3, a wonderful voice. She started singing at age maybe 2 in her house. And just was constantly musical in her life. Why don't I? So I decided, okay, let's think about the Maria we've always known, not pregnant teen. And what that led us to do was to connect Maria to a friend of ours who was the choir director in a big Catholic parish about 6 blocks away from our house. And I asked the choir director, I have this young friend, who's really got a terrific voice, I think. Would you mind sort of listening to her and seeing what you think? And so the choir director assented, and she came and listened to Maria, and Maria just blew her away with the voice, and immediately the choir director recruited Maria to become part of the choir, which Maria did, and at that time, I'm going to shorten this a lot, the choir was beginning to do its Christmas CD with 15 different carols, and it turned out that on about half of the carols when the CD came out, Maria was the lead singer and the choir was the sort of backup to Maria's voice. And Maria got into the choir and the choir began seeing that Maria was getting larger and larger. The younger women in the choir began sort of gathering around Maria and talking with her about pregnancy and healthy birthing and prenatal care and postnatal care. And by the time the child was born, the choir had organized itself into a series of sort of daycare supports so that Maria's mother could keep working and Maria could continue in high school and continue her music studies. And so Maria now is the well-supported single mom. The child is a lovely 2-year-old and Maria has begun school on a music scholarship in college. Now, I think maybe, so what was that about? That was about the first category, the talents and skills of a person who was also possibly defined by their emptiness, connected with a local association called the choir, which had a connection with a physical asset called the recording studio, which began to open up economic possibilities for Maria and her future. So I now think that a lot of the most important community building work is simply this connection work. People who are constantly looking for the connections that make sense. Not the professional help, but the connections among folks and associations. So that's step two. Find the assets, connect the assets, and finally then in a whole lot of communities across the United States and across the world, when possible, harness the connected assets to a widely held vision of the future. Figure out how a community can get together and decide in some kind of general way, what do we want this place to be like 10 years from now? What do we want it to be like for kids, for families, for jobs, for the physical environment? Where do we want to be and how do we use our assets to get there? Find the assets, connect the assets, harness them to a vision. You'll notice that none of those three steps says write a grant to the government. And let me just end by making that logic clear. And the logic is not that we have all we need in our communities, but the logic is you don't know what you need until you know what you've got, right? So let's start with what we've got, and then we can see the gaps, or we can see the possibilities for how the outside resources can invest in and strengthen what we've already got. The last image that we like to use a lot with governments and funders is, how do you change your relationship to communities from charity to investment? The old way of doing business is communities hold out your hand, be convincing about how bad things are, and we'll give you some resources and some experts and some programs from the outside. A much more challenging but much more promising set of relationships is, how do we as governments, funders, invest in your resources and assets so that you are the first community, you are the first players, you are the first investors in your own future? So the community is asked, don't just tell us about your problems, also tell us what you've got and where you're going with what you've got. And we want to invest in that, not in the outside stuff. So all of these 13 cases from 12 different countries across the globe are about communities in a whole variety of different contexts, cultures, histories, that have redefined their relationships in that way. How do we understand as Ecuadorian indigenous people that we have, because we know how to grow herbs that are medicinal and aromatic for ourselves, how do we begin to understand that there are other Ecuadorians who might like those too, and we can connect with them? And how do we then begin a global business based on the internet that sells our centuries-old skills to the world? Right? So that's what ABCD is. Thank you. I wish we had some time to go back and forth, but I'm around, so let's do that for sure. Thank you. Thank you.